from WCVB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Take 5 Podcast. Our guest today is going to be Mike Lynch, the Dean of Boston Sportscasters. Ellen, Mike Lynch has a lot of great stories to tell, and I could listen to him talk all day.
He has unreal stories. He comes from a different generation of reporters who had a totally different experience than the one you're having.
It's a great point. I think he was really sort of part of the last generation of reporters that were on an even plane with the athletes, and they sort of had this human-to-human relationship.
Right. This is before social media, before they could just go out and say whatever it is they wanted on Twitter, on Instagram. So we learned during this podcast that we don't always say the right things. And although Mike Lynch has incredible stories, I think the best story is the one where Chris Gasper embarrassed himself in front of a supermodel.
Yes. I can say it was not, it's not the only time I've embarrassed myself in front of a supermodel, Ellen, but it was indeed the first time. And I would just say it was a lesson in the fact that you don't always recognize celebrities when you see them in person, because like the magazines say, they are just like us in real life.
Okay, well, yeah. I can't believe you have two stories about talking to supermodels.
Yes,
that's impressive in itself.
Well, I'll tell you, what's really interesting is that I think Mike Lynch was at the vanguard of realizing that Tom Brady was going to be Tom Brady. And it's fascinating to listen to him talk about how he knew and had learned as a reporter that there was something to this Tom Brady kid who was a fourth string quarterback originally, was pick number 199, a sixth round pick, that his career was going to be something memorable. And Tom and Giselle, I'm really, really sorry.
I don't think Giselle lost any sleep over it.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I think she's just fine.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
And now we're joined by a very special guest, as promised, the Dean of Boston Sportscasters, the one and only Mike Lynch. Lynchy, thanks for joining us.
CG, good to have you sitting across from me. And it's turned around now. You get to ask me the questions. I'm excited about this.
Oh, it's not an interview, Lynchy. It's just two North Shore guys having a conversation.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
So as you mentioned, I'm on your turf here, Channel 5. You pretty much built this place from a sports standpoint. So I want to ask you, I'm still fairly new on the job, still learning a lot of names and faces and how to do this. Do you remember your first couple of days on the job here at Channel 5 and what they were like and what was going through your head?
I came in on a Friday night, March 26th. They needed someone to fill in. Brian Leary was working, Don Gillis, Clark Booth were the three people. So they gave me a script after the 6 o'clock news. In those days, it went 6 to 7. At 7 o'clock, I came down and I read the script on the set. And I still have the tape, and I would not hire me for Needham Cable Television. It was so pathetically bad. And I basically said, the Red Sox beat the Detroit Tigers today in spring training. Now let's take a look at the highlights. And then my head went down to read the script to the highlights and see if they would match up. So we finish, and we go upstairs to Jim Thistle's office, who was the news director at the time.
I had him as a professor at Boston University.
Yeah, talk about the dean. He's the dean of all news directors.
Yes.
So he's sitting, he's looking at the tape. He said, how'd you think you did? I said, I would need 8 hours a day, minimum 6 months full time to be even ready to go on the weekend. He said, well, you don't have that long. He says, you're on tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. Shortly thereafter, Don Gillis got a prostate infection. So Brian Leary would anchor Monday through Friday. I would anchor Saturday and Sunday. And then as soon as Gillis got better, Brian Leary got hepatitis. So I basically, that first year when I was part-time, 48 out of the 52 weeks, I worked three or more days a week.
Oh, wow.
So it was great timing. And I was in the right place at the right time, because this is an inexact science. This isn't like going to law school or a medical school where you know you're going to be, you know, you pass the bar after a couple of years and, you know, you become a resident, an intern, medical. This is all timing. It's an inexact science, as you know. And I was a lucky guy to do it in the town where I grew up in. So I never had to look at an encyclopedia in those days or Google anything now when everyone mentions when Halachek stole the ball, because I was either there or I was listening to it in the radio.
Wow, that's amazing. You're absolutely right about being at the right place in the right time. Yeah. Obviously, talent, and you have it in spades, means a lot in this business, but you need a little bit of luck as well to be able to do it. And could you have ever imagined at that time when you started, when you were robotically reading those highlights, that you would have the career that you've had, you've become the institution you've become?
I always felt like it was an insecure business, as we know, that you're basically at the whim of the ratings, a news director who may not like you, a general manager who may not like you. And so I'm lucky that I either fooled them or they weren't paying attention for 38 years and they kept me around here this long. But I would, after every single show, I would get a tape and I would put it in and I would watch myself very much the same way you would watch yourself in a basketball or a football game. I kind of coached myself, and then after a while, I threw away the script and I just wrote little notes and bullet points. And I felt someone said, just pretend, be more conversational. You know, don't talk at the people, talk with the people. And that was pretty good advice that someone gave me. And so that's pretty much what's carried me through all those years.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear this from you, because your calling card, what you're known as in this business, is one of the all-time great ad-libbers, somebody who can just off the top of their head go in any situation. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about starting out and reading a script, because you're known for not needing a script.
I would have a stopwatch and I would say, okay, here comes John Havlicek with the ball. Okay, well, the script is, I wrote 8 seconds and the shot only lasts 7 seconds. I got to get a couple of words out of here. And I would keep doing it over and over again, because basically I would read and hope that my reading synced up with the highlights. And finally, I just threw those things away and I just talked. And rather than describing what was on the screen, anybody can see that Larry Bird's making a jump shot or Robert Parrish is making one of his rainbow shots off the baseline, supplement it with some information.
Yeah.
To this day, I still, you know, you've got to do your homework. People say to me, do you ever get nervous when you go on the air? And I said, the only time I get nervous was when I didn't do my homework. And even like, you know, we recently have done some pregame shows.
Yes, for the Celtics.
And I, you know, make sure that I do a research on who scored what, whose stats are going on. And when you was talking one day about Marcus Smart shooting 7.6% from 3-point land, I said, well, I know he's 1 for 13, but I didn't know what the percentage was.
Do you remember the event or the moment when you felt like you belonged, when you felt like you were sort of the Mike Lynch that we know and love?
One of the big things in those days was getting a scoop, and scoops were really big. We were very competitive with Bob Lobel on Channel 4 and John Dennis on Channel 7. And if you had something at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it would hold till 6 o'clock at night. Same thing in the newspaper. You know, I know guys who get scoops and, you know, they wait till, you know, the 6 o'clock in the morning, hope that nobody else found out about it. And I think that during the Doug Flutie years, like I started here in 82, and like in 84, Doug Flutie had won the Heisman Trophy. They were all playing in Orlando, the United States Football League. He was playing for Donald Trump's team, the New Jersey Generals,
that's right.
But he was the backup quarterback. A guy named Brian Sipe was the quarterback.
I remember Brian Sipe.
From the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah.
So we're sitting down there ready to go live. The other two guys, Mike Dowling was working for Channel 4. Gary Gillis was working for Channel 7. They went to Bennigan's to eat. And I said, I'm going to just hang around. And this guy, Dave Lapham from Syracuse, who played for the Bengals and is still part of the Bengals radio broadcast, came over to me in the lobby of the Holiday Inn. He said, hey, did you hear what just happened? I said, what? He said, Brian Sipe just got traded to Jacksonville, I think it was. He says, what are you talking about? He says, he's my roommate. He's loading his bike into his pickup truck right back there. And I had Doug Flutie lined up as a live guest. So Flutie's sitting there, and this all happened in a matter of seconds. I go, okay, Lynchy, you got 30 seconds. You're coming back right now. And Flutie's sitting here. And I just said, okay, we're back. Doug, I just got some news from one of your teammates right here. Brian Sipe has been traded. You are now the starting quarterback of the New Jersey Generals. He went, what? I said, you are now the starting quarterback of the New Jersey Generals. He said, well, how'd you know? I said, I got a very reliable source who just told me that. You got it. He said, wow, that's unbelievable. So we did a live broadcast. I felt so bad for Gary Gillis and Mike Dowling, who were friends of mine, that I went to the Yellow Pages and I called the Bennigans in Orlando. I said, can you page, you know, I said, you guys better get back here because the New Jersey Generals are having a press conference in like 30 minutes. I think Walt Michaels was the head coach at the time. And so those guys came back. And then by 11 o'clock, the thing had exploded. So I think right about then I said, you know what? Gee, I broke a story on live television. So I think, you know, I think my job is safe for the next, you know, 6 months or so. And my comfort level, I think, started right from there.
That is a fascinating story. I also have to say, I think it's really interesting, very magnanimous of you to call those guys. I don't think everybody would have done that. I think they would have like exclusive. Oh, the other stations don't have anything from this press conference.
Well, I told those guys, I said, look, I got to do a live shot with Doug Flutie. I said, when I'm done, I'll meet you guys at Bennigan's. So I didn't want them sitting there like, you know, finishing their cheeseburgers waiting for me to show up. But I felt bad. I went to college with Gary Gillis.
Okay.
I knew Mike Dowling from just being a competitor. He was at Channel 4 at the time. And I just felt it was the right thing to do.
And where did you and Gary go to college?
We went to Cambridge College of Upholstery. Right?
That would be Harvard, folks. He doesn't want to say. That would be Harvard. One of the more interesting things, and you and I have talked about this, I've had the opportunity to cover Bill Belichick for a long time, probably one of the smartest people I've ever come in contact with, inside or outside of sports. You, I think, have a much better relationship with Bill than I do. So I want to know, what was your mentality? What is your mentality when you prepare to interview Bill Belichick? And do you get nervous like the rest of us?
I do get nervous. I did a show with him for about 10 years. We taped it every Wednesday morning around 9:30. So I would get home from work about 12:30 in the morning after the 11 o'clock news, and I would lie in bed because I had to be fresh with everything. Everything had to be – whatever I do right before I shut the lights out will stay in my brain the next morning. So rather than doing it on Tuesday afternoon, because something else will clutter up the big file cabinet between the ears here. So – but I would be – I knew that if I didn't know every single play that happened in the game, he would call me on it. So I'm thinking, what kind of questions can I ask him that will be interesting? They're not your typical questions that that most people would ask at a press conference, and try to get him to loosen up a little bit. And, you know, I'd write up, sometimes I'd scribble some things out. You know, there were some tough questions you had to ask him in the middle of Spygate. I said, got to ask you the question. I'm not going to answer it, but I got to ask you the question. And, you know, fair enough. We moved on from there. But I had a good relationship with him. It dated back to when we got out of high school. He went to Annapolis High School in Maryland. He graduated in 1970. I went to Swampscott, and I was 1971. Both of our dads were coaches, and both of our dads thought we weren't smart enough. We're too immature, and we weren't good enough athletes to go straight to college. So they encouraged both of us to go to prep school. So Bill went to Phillips Andover. Well, I was a senior at high school. And when I was a senior in high school, his coach, Steve Sirota, brought the film down of the Andover Exeter game, and they threw 40 passes. They beat Exeter 34-6. And I said, oh, I'm going to go to Phillips Andover. So I went up for my interview. Now, I had no idea who Bill Belichick was at the time. I wanted to make a long story short, I went to Exeter. So for 1 year after Swampscott, before I went to Harvard. So, we had a big game against Andover. It's like a Thanksgiving Day game. It was for the New England Championship. We won. We're down 20-3. We won 30-20. I had a pretty good game, and I was a kicker and a quarterback. And Belichick was at the game because he was a freshman at Wesleyan. So now my freshman year at Harvard, three of my roommates are from Andover. They played football and lacrosse with Bill Belichick. Some of his teammates and roommates at Wesleyan were teammates and classmates of mine at Exeter.
Ah.
So now we play do you know Chris Gasper? Yeah, I know Chris Gasper. Sure. Yeah, he was a great lacrosse player. Da, 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 da. So that stuff sort of, you know, helped break the ice. The fact that I was a quarterback, and when he starts talking about the Mike, the Sam, the Willie, cover two, cover one, sky, cloud, you know, check off, hot receiver, you know, I still remember that from being a quarterback at Harvard. And I think, you know, he had a modicum of respect for me that I was somebody that knew what he was talking about. Plus the fact that he had seen me play and I had seen him play on film. And I think he knew I wasn't going to submarine him with any crazy question, probe into his personal life or anything like that. And so I think there was a comfort level there. And I mean, we're not best friends. I don't go out with him. You know, I see him occasionally, you know, at a Celtics game or a Bruins game, and we chat for a little bit. But, you know, and I don't want to overplay this, that we're best friends and we have each other's cell phone numbers. But there was a comfort level and a trust factor there that still exists today. And, you know, from all those things that sort of just intersected.
That's really fascinating. You guys are contemporaries. I think that's sort of a natural relationship. And certainly Bill Belichick's not particularly forthcoming, but I always felt he was maybe a little more forthcoming and a little more comfortable with you. You mentioned that he'd seen you play. You had seen him play. Obviously, your days at Swampscott High, Phillips Exeter, and Harvard. Did he ever ask you to share any of your football experiences? And is there one that sort of stands out where he asked you about a play or an experience you had as a football player?
Well, I had a couple of his teammates were at Andover were teammates of mine at Harvard. One was Milt Holt, a Hawaiian quarterback who was a great, great quarterback. He was a year ahead of me, and I also played baseball with him. But you know, he asked me one day, he said, you know, I said, how many passes do you think you've thrown in your life, starting from when you were playing touch football when you were 8 years old? And I said, I don't know, 100,000, you know, maybe. I just picked a random number out of the air. He said, did you ever get a sore shoulder? And I said, no. I said, why? He said, I don't know. He said, I just, you know, some of my quarterbacks are like, you know, they late in the year, their shoulder's tired, and they just, I think it helps giving them a day off. He's, of course, meeting Tom Brady. Remember Brady would always never come out on a Wednesday once you get into December. Yep.
And he was on the injury report with the shoulder all 500 weeks in a row or whatever that was.
All the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say, no, I never had a problem. I mean, the funny thing was, about 6 months later, I tore my rotator cuff.
You jinxed yourself.
But I think I was getting something off the top shelf in the garage when I did it. But it was funny. So he asked me that question. And then the injury report, that was a Wednesday morning. The injury report came out in the afternoon. So I saw him next Wednesday, and I said, now I know why he asked me about the shoulder thing. And he just sort of smiled and just winked at me, you know. And most of the conversations we would have were very enlightening before the red light went on. You know, we had children the same age, you know. And he'd come in, and he's like shaking his head. I said, what's the matter? He says, where'd you go on spring break when you were in college? I said, Revere Beach, probably. You know, that's as far as I got. You know, and he says, where'd you go? He says, I just went down to the shore in Annapolis. My daughter's going to Costa Rica. Why does she have to go to Costa Rica? Huh? Why does she have to go to Costa Rica? You know, and I said, well, it's funny. My daughter's going to some place in Cozumel or something like that. I can't even spell the damn place. He goes, geez, what's blah, 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 blah. Then I'd come in and my knuckles would be all cut one day. He said, what happened to your knuckles? And I said, well, my daughter moved into the 5-decker in South Boston and no elevator. And of course, daddy is, you know, lifting the couch around the corner and the box spring and everything. And he said, did your parents ever help you move in anywhere? I said, no. I said, my father never even knew where I lived. He dropped me off at Wonderland, gave me a quarter. And, you know, I was living in Somerville, you know, over by the Tufts football field. He didn't know. He says, when I went to Phillips Andover, my father bought me a train ticket from Annapolis to Hartford, Connecticut. And from Hartford, Connecticut to Andover, I hitchhiked.
Wow.
He said, you know, and it was like, and I had a duffel bag, and that was it. And I said, you know, you're on your own. Good luck. Have a good year. And that's basically how it worked. But that's what happened back in those days.
Oh, wow.
Okay, 3-2-1, go. Well, Mike, Denver's a very good defensive team. They have a good special teams. They have a good offense. You know, they're really well balanced. So he gets into his
broadcast. It's an affect. I mean, people who know him, you know, there are people who think that's the real Bill Belichick. And you know him better than I do, but it's not. He has a tremendous sense of humor.
He does.
A dry sense of humor that's outstanding. He has fantastic comedic timing. And really, I think if you read even Education of a Coach or some of these other things, the way he is, how droll he is with the media, that seems like it's an affect that he has developed over the years.
There's no question about it. I mean, I've seen him at some of his funniest. You know, he's had me in stitches a few times. When we did the Belestrator, we used to have it the week of the Andover Exeter game. Whoever won the game got to write the score of the game on the screen. So if Exeter lost and Andover won the previous Saturday, I'd say, all right, Bill, thanks a lot. He goes, whoa, we're not done just yet. And he'd pick up the pen, and he'd write Andover 24, Exeter 6. He goes, now we're done. We can get going. And he's always said yes to a one-on-one interview. After he finishes his press conference, I usually go out in the hallway with him for like 5 minutes. And he's very, very good. And it's very nice of him to do that, because I know that every second of every day is accounted for. And he's moving on to the next interview, the next meeting, the next practice, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah, I mean, he obviously has a great respect for you. I think two people at the top of their professions and contemporaries, and that makes sense. And I'll just tell a little quick story with Bill. This is just in a press conference, but about his comedic timing. I was early on covering the team. I want to say it was 06 or 07. I was sitting next to Bert Breer, who now works for Sports Illustrated. Yeah. And you can usually tell how Bill feels about the week of practice and about the opponent and where they're at based on Friday. His big thing on Friday is, you know, basically the hay's in the barn. Yeah. And he either feels good about it or he doesn't. And if he feels good, he'll be a little looser on Friday. Yeah. And so someone asked him about whether they had players who would contact the team trying to get a tryout. And he just looked out. He said, oh, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't believe the volume of tapes we get. I mean, we get all kinds of tapes, you know. And so someone said, well, what's on the tapes, Bill? Like, you know, and he goes, and he just, without breaking like a stride or changing facial expression, he goes, oh, yeah, you know, it's some guy in a park catching passes from his girlfriend, thinks that he's going to play in the NFL. Like, and he didn't even break stride. And Bert Breer and I are sitting in the front row and we start slouching. We are dying laughing. And Bill just kind of looks at us. And gives a little wry smile, you know, knowing that he's entertained the crowd. And he keeps going a little bit more about these videos and that they get. And you know, just guys, you know, Joe Blow on the street who thinks he can play for the Patriots sending in some video. He went down to the park and he's catching passes from his friends and all that stuff. And it was just hysterical. And to this day, I always remember that. And even though Bill didn't really break character, he did a little bit because he could see us laughing, just dying laughing in the front row. And that was like a pretty cool story. And it speaks to sort of Bill's ability to entertain and tell stories. So you know the real Bill Belichick. I've gotten to see a little bit of it. I think that's one of the things that really speaks highly of you, Lynchy, is that throughout the course of your career, and people don't understand a lot of times, this is a people business, and you have a great way of being able to connect with people and put people at ease to the point that I know when I was on camera with you, I would forget that we were on camera.
I guess that's a compliment, but I make it conversational. Talk with the people, talk with your subject, not at your subject. And Bill would always come in whenever they beat the Jets. He'd always come in, sit down. The first thing he'd say, he goes, how you doing? Always good to get a win over the Jets. And he's smiling and give me a little wink for all the obvious reasons, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people who don't remember, there's some younger people might not remember that before he came here, it was very controversial. He was lined up to be Bill Parcells' successor. Parcells stepped aside. He was technically the new head coach, and then he retired famously on a napkin. I should say resigned. He didn't retire. He resigned, saying he didn't want to be the HC of the NYJ because he had this job lined up here. And Steve Gutman, the then president of the Jets, publicly questioned Bill's faculties. He said, this is obviously a man in turmoil. I don't think that's something that Bill has ever forgotten, the fact that Steve Gutman tried to portray a strategic decision he made, which obviously was the right decision, as Bill Belichick basically flying off the handle and losing his faculties. I do want to ask you a little bit more about this, because there's something that you and I have talked about that I want you to talk about with the people, which is that sometimes Bill does tip his hand with people he feels comfortable with. And maybe before some other people knew what Tom Brady was going to be, you had an idea that Bill Belichick knew Tom Brady was something special, not just your run-of-the-mill six-round pick.
Well, we used to do the preseason games, and I did them with Don Crickey and Jerry Glanville and Randy Cross eventually. So back in the fall or the summer of 2001, we'd come in to the production meeting the night before the first preseason game. And you know, Don Crickey would say, so, Bill, who's been the most impressive so far? Tom Brady. So which guy has made the most Tom Brady. Well, which guy has really opened a Tom Brady? So I'm going, something going on here. I said, you know, every single answer is Tom Brady, Tom Brady, Tom Brady, Tom Brady. And then he would give him, you know, more opportunity than you would give a backup quarterback in a preseason game. And I think that if Mo Lewis did not knock Drew Bledsoe out in that September game back in 2001, that eventually, before the season was over, Tom Brady was going to be the starting quarterback.
That is fascinating. There's another story you've told me that I'd like you to tell the people. You knew before some other folks that with the Brady Bledsoe decision that had to be made that year in the playoffs, remember in AFC Championship game, that Tom Brady got hurt and Drew Bledsoe came off the bench and threw a touchdown pass and led the Patriots to the Super Bowl. And this is really the beginning of the dynasty. So there was a question there. Drew Bledsoe was the franchise quarterback. He had been displaced by injury by this young upstart, Tom Brady, this Cinderella signal caller. And there was a decision to be made. And there was not the customary 2 weeks between the championship games and the Super Bowl because of September 11th and that tragedy. There was only 1 week. And so a decision had to be made, and you had an inkling that Brady was going to start before most folks.
Well, here's what happened. As having the Patriots pregame, Patriots All Access show, we got two rooms in the hotel. One for me, one for Mike Cole, the sports photographer. Ironically, my hotel room was right next to a hotel room. Wasn't where Bill Belichick slept, but Bill Belichick used that room as his office. So I come back from doing something. I'm walking down the hallway with Mike Cole, and there's Tom Brady sitting in a chair right outside my room, right between the door of my room and Bill Belichick's room. And he's got, you know, he's got a hat on. I said, hey, what are you doing? You know, he said, you being punished or something sitting in the hallway right here? He said, no. He says, coach is telling us who's going to be starting Sunday in the Super Bowl against the Rams. I said, oh. I said, are you waiting for? He goes, well, Drew's in there right now. I said, oh, okay. So I pretended I couldn't, you know, get my key, my door unlocked, you know, because I wanted to see how this is going to play out, you know, and I didn't want to really bug him too much. All of a sudden, the door opens, and Tom Brady, if Drew Bledsoe looked down to his right, he would have seen Tom sitting in a chair, just like the one I'm sitting in, or me standing there fumbling, looking for my room key. And then he didn't even look at Tom. He just took a left and just stormed down the hallway. And Tom just stood up, shrugged his shoulders, and gave like a double thumbs up. He goes, must be me. So he goes in. And of course, I'm getting the glass, and I'm trying to listen through the wall to see if I can hear what Belichick is saying. I'm exaggerating, but I was, you know, just sort of like, you know, when the door opens, can I get him? And I missed him when he came back out because I thought Bill might be there, and Bill might be kind of ticked off that I was crossing the line. So I saw Brady a little bit later, and I just gave a thumbs up, and you know, in the hotel, and he went, yeah, he gave a thumbs up. So we called him. I said, can we do an interview with you? He said, yeah. I said, but I don't want to go out on the sidewalk, you know, where you guys are. I said, well, no, you can come to Lynchy's room. He says, well, which one's Lynchy's? He says, right next to Belichick's. So he comes down. He's wearing a Red Sox hat, and but Mike Cole's got his camera there. I get the microphone, and he walks in. And for some reason, my room had like gigantic – the ceilings were about 15 feet high, and I had two beds instead of like one bed, you know, and those guys all had roommates. He comes in and goes, wow, look at this room. It's unbelievable. I said, well, I'm not in it very often, and I don't know what a room service, but yeah, it's kind of cool. So we did the interview right in my room, you know, and then he goes out and gets – this is really a cool room. He says,
Tom Brady.
He says, you get a room like this, and I get, you know, I'm upstairs. I think he was probably rooming with he might be rooming with Bledsoe. Who knows?
Oh, geez.
I know. So anyway, that's how it happened. That's how I found out. We put it on the air, and the rest is history.
Oh, now I have to ask you, how did you see Tom Brady evolve as a player and a person during his time there? Because it's interesting. This is somebody who's like, one of my passions is architecture, and like his house is in like Architectural Digest talking about in 2000 how he loved your hotel room.
Maybe that's where it started, right there. Huh?
Maybe.
I thought he developed as a person and as a quarterback remarkably. To me, to this day, I still think he's the same guy that was drafted 197 or 196. What is it? It's, I always get
199.
199, yeah. At sixth round, 199. And so, you know, every time I see him, even in those big cluster interviews at the Super Bowl when they're in these big ballrooms, you know, I could be standing, you know, six deep, and he'll come in, he'll just mouth, "Hi, Mike," you know, and that's like, hey, you know, he hasn't forgotten. I'll tell you one quick story. When all three of my daughters went to Boston College. One of them, Molly, did a semester in Florence. And my phone rang one Sunday morning. Dad, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. I'm with all my girlfriends. You know, we're getting some, you know, cappuccino and da, 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 da. I look across the street and there's this tall, handsome guy with a Red Sox hat on and a beautiful woman walking down the street. And this is when he just started dating Giselle. This was Molly got out in 08. So this is probably spring of 07.
Yeah, that would make sense because that's right around the time.
Yeah.
I'll tell a quick Giselle story.
So she yells out, Tom, and Giselle grabbed his hand and they sprinted down the street to get away from these six college girls. And Molly just yells out, "I'm Mike Lynch's daughter." And he stopped. He went, "Really?" And he turned around and he walked back and he said, "How are you?" I said, "Hi, ladies. How you doing? What are you studying? Oh, you know, I really wish I could have done this, but I always had spring practice, you know, and da, 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 da." And he spent 10 minutes with him. And then afterwards, Molly goes, "Tom, I really hate to do this to you, but Giselle, could I have your autograph, please?" He goes, "I'm going to get your father for this one." And, but couldn't have been nicer, you know? I mean, he didn't have to do anything like that. You know, he's, you know, having a private time in, you know, Florence, Italy, getting away from everybody and everything else. So it was kind of cool.
Oh, that is a great story. I've always said that if I were to have any child, male or female, I would, and they became famous, I would want them to behave the way Tom Brady does. To this day, he will look you in the eye when you ask him a question, yeah, which is a small thing, but yeah, it makes a difference, right, especially in these huge press conferences. Whoever asked the question, he will look you in the eye. Here's a small, embarrassing Gisele Bündchen story that I'm going to tell, and I don't think I've ever told this publicly. So 2006 playoffs, 2007 calendar year, they play that game in San Diego against the Chargers.
Yes.
And that Chargers team was the number one seed. They were a super talented team. It was my first year on the Patriots beat. So the Patriots come back. It's the Marlon McCree game. It's the lights out. It's Ellis Hobbs doing the lights out Sean Merriman dance on the field and then and yelling lights out in the Chargers locker room. If you remember afterwards, that was when LaDainian Tomlinson ripped Bill Belichick, said, you know, that team has no class and it starts with the head coach. So very memorable game.
Yes.
But memorable for me for a different reason. So we're waiting
in the hallway.
In the hallway. In the hallway outside the locker room. And the late, great Danny Pyers says to me, that's Gisele Bündchen, points to this tall, blonde, California looking girl with a baseball cap on and like a flannel shirt.
Yeah. Looks like she's about 16.
Yeah, not that far away. Probably, I mean, I know people can't see us, but probably, you know, about as far away as I am from you, Lynchy. And, you know, the adrenaline's flowing after this game. It was a tight game. They would come back for the Patriots. And I very loudly go, that's not Gisele Bündchen. Gisele Bündchen's way hotter than that. She definitely heard me, looked over. Kind of just cracked a smile. And I didn't think anything of it, you know, whatever. I'm like, that wasn't Gisele Bündchen, like, whatever. And then the next day, it's in the inside track, the Herald, that Gisele Bündchen was at the game. And here's what she was wearing, this baseball cap and a flannel shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm so sorry, Gisele. I didn't mean it. So I just, I definitely put my foot in my mouth on that one.
I remember it like it was yesterday because we were all in this hallway waiting to get into the interview room, right?
Narrow hallway. If you remember, the locker room was split up, like offense, defense, the visiting locker room, because it was so small.
Yes, we were waiting to get in. And then someone told me out there, I said, maybe that's Tom's younger sister. I mean, she looks like she's in high school. And then of course, everyone found out.
Yeah.
So you broke that story.
I don't think so. All right, last question for you here as we wrap it up. I do want to ask you about Danny Ainge, just because you covered him as a player. It's interesting. So many of these guys now you covered as players, and they're in front office roles or broadcasting roles. Do you have any Danny Ainge stories, and what was he like to interview as a player?
He was good. He was kind of like the guy that you went to school with that, like, you know, was the instigator in all the little scuffles and fights that broke out in the schoolyard. He's the one that would say something and go up into behind somebody and just you know, kick him in the calf and then run away, and the person turned around and then, you know, wound up getting into a brawl with somebody else. Now Danny had his share of getting into tussles. What's his name? Tree Rollins.
Tree Rollins, yeah.
With the Celtics. But he was a good feisty player. When he came here, I thought that he'd be a better basketball player than a baseball player with the Blue Jays. He was fun to cover. He was friends with Mike Dowling. They both were members of the Church of Latter-day Saints.
Oh, yes.
And they were neighbors. So we kind of had an in with him if we needed an interview. I have, you know, nothing but great things to say about him getting a live guest was tough. And when you get one, you're very grateful for whoever does it, even if they, you know, don't say anything on the air. It's just presence. It's perception. You got somebody right there. So Ainge was good. He was good to cover. And one of the things that we'll talk about this maybe if you ever have me back on, I used to referee Celtic scrimmages in the 80s. And, you know, Ainge was brutal, but they all were, you know, what are you talking about traveling? I didn't travel anything. I didn't touch him. What do you call a foul on me for? That was an offensive foul, you know, and just relentless on me. He said, Danny, enough. It's a scrimmage, you know, nobody cares. He says, we care. So it was pretty funny.
Oh, some things don't change. He still is all over those officials. Well,
always.
Lynchy, I could talk to you for 6 hours, but we do have a limit here. Thank you so much for joining us. That's the one and only Mike Lynch, the man, the myth, the legend, joining us here, the Dean of Channel 5 on the Take 5 podcast. Thanks again, Lynchy.
My pleasure, CG. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. As always, you can catch the Take 5 podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, we want you to go on there, subscribe, rate. It helps other people find the podcast. We'll catch you next time.